Thank you, Mr. Summers. You believe some things that are physically impossible. Absolutely impossible. You believe some things that cannot be explained through laws commonly accessible to humans. You believe in a God who cannot be seen, nor heard, nor touched, and yet exists more real than anything we can see, hear, or touch. Now, when this God interacts in the physical realm to contradict the laws of, quote-unquote, nature, natural law, when he steps in to suspend the laws of the physical world, we refer to them as miracles. Miracles. Miracles are impossible. The definition of a miracle is this: a surprising and welcome event that is not explicable by natural or scientific laws and is therefore considered to be the work of a divine agency. Since God created and sustains the laws that govern the physical, it is a small thing for Him to suspend them and act as He wishes. He made them so He can suspend them. Today what I'd like to do with you is examine miracles in the Bible, the miracles specifically performed by the prophet Elisha, to see what we might learn from applying these lessons in our lives. I doubt that very many of us, if any, would ever have these miracles repeated in our lives. So there must be some reason for them being written that we can apply as we examine these things that technically are impossible. Let's take a look at some of the miracles of Elijah to see what we might learn. Turn first to 2 Kings chapter 2. 2 Kings chapter 2. As you know, the end of 1 Kings deals with Elijah, as does the first part of 2 Kings 2. But then it transfers to the stories surrounding the life of Elisha, who did inherit, we might say, the leadership role of the prophets after Elijah was taken away. 2 Kings chapter 2, beginning in verse 19. Here's how I've listed the point. Our well must be pure. Our well must be pure. Let's look at why we state this point this way. A usable miracle for us? Well, no, but the lesson, very much so. 2 Kings 2, beginning in verse 9. And so it was when they had crossed over that Elijah says to Elisha, "Ask, what shall I do for you before I'm taken away?" Elisha said, "Please let a double portion of your spirit be upon me." And as we know, Elijah is taken away. His mantle falls to the ground. Elisha sees it all. He picks it up. And God grants this promise. So Elisha takes that same mantle, smacks the Jordan River. It splits open. He crosses on dry ground. And everybody knows that Elisha is now in the role, in the power and spirit, we might say, of Elijah. So let's take a look at verse 19. He comes back to the city. Verse 19, the men of the city said to Elisha, "Please notice the situation of this city is pleasant. Nice place to live. Nice view. We seem to have everything we need, but there's a problem. As my Lord sees, but the water is bad and the ground barren." Bad water. It is interesting to note that bad water is a problem all over the world to this day. In fact, thousands, hundreds of thousands, yes, millions of people suffer because they do not have clean water to drink. So, he says in verse 20, "Bring me a new bowl and put salt in it." And so they brought it to him. Now you ask yourself, is a new bowl full of salt going to do anything to fix the water problem that this city, apparently the city of Jericho, was suffering from? Would that solve anything? Was there something in the salt? No, it was salt. Interesting. He says, bring me this bowl full of salt. They brought it to him. He went out into the source of the water. So apparently this well from which they would gather all their water. He went out to the source of the water, cast in the salt there, and said, thus says the Eternal, I have healed this water. From it there shall be no more death or barrenness. In other words, this water was somehow so polluted that it not only made people sick and killed them, it polluted the ground in such a way that nothing would grow. So he takes this bowl of salt. Doesn't say how big it is. It's a new bowl. Might have been a small bowl. Might have been a big bowl. Maybe been a custard cup. Doesn't say. But it's a bowl. Put salt and throw it into the well. And it's fixed. That is absolutely impossible. And yet that's what happened. The word for spring here, or source, is the word for spring. So apparently he tosses it into this area where this spring is flowing out with all this polluted water. And this small bit of salt cures it, or did it? Well, the salt really did not cure the well. God's miracle did. God directly intervening. So what might we learn from this? Do we take salt then and go salt? Well, we know salt for our water might soften it up a little bit, but it doesn't make it unpoisonous or unpolluted. What do we learn from this outstanding miracle? Well, can we hope to have a pure product if our source is polluted? For Christians, this should encourage us to be sure that what we are allowing into our minds and into our hearts is purified by salt. It is pure water. A daily salting, we might say, of God's Word is needed for a Christian mind to stay pure. To allow clear, clean water, the water of God's Holy Spirit, to flow out from us requires a pure source. So we ask ourselves as we look at this miracle, oh, it's a nice story, nice to see it go by, but we ask ourselves, what are we allowing into our minds? Are worldly influences polluting us? The mind and outlook must be salted. Salt, we know, has cleansing properties, has mild antiseptic properties. You can put it on a wound and it cleans it out. It's not pleasant to put salt in a wound, but it does purify. That's why it was used that way in ancient times. So we examine ourselves to see if we are unintentionally, or maybe through indifference, or in some cases even intentionally, polluting our well, producing water that will sicken us and even be a bad influence upon others. So we ask ourselves, how is our source doing? Are we allowing wrong things? Good examination technique as we go along. Let's go on to another miracle of Elisha. And there are many to choose from. But we'll go on to the next one in 2 Kings chapter 2, beginning in verse 23. It mentions in verse 22, the water remained healed to this day according to the word of Elisha, which spoke. But then it says in verse 23, then he went up from there to Bethel. Now pause for a second. What do you remember about Bethel from your studies of the Bible in the past? Well, you probably remember, okay, Bethel, this is where as Jacob was leaving, he's fleeing, he sets up the stone, he puts his head on the stone, or he has his headboard, and then he sees this spectacular miracle of angels coming up and down on the ladder to and from heaven. So we remember that. How about as we move through Israel's history? What else happens in Bethel? Well, we'll get to that in a moment. You might remember. It's interesting that in this case, verse 23, then he went up to Bethel. As he was going up the road, some youths came from the city and mocked him. Wow. Why would youth from Bethel mock the prophet of God? It's not like they didn't know who Elisha was. They knew that he had been associated with Elijah. I mean, was it just somebody walking down the road and they decided to make fun of this guy? No, they knew who he was. very likely, it seems to me to make sense, that since the city of Bethel is mentioned, what was one of the centers of pagan worship after Israel collapsed, spiritually speaking? Bethel was one of those areas of centralized pagan worship. So it's very likely that these young men... Now, it's interesting that in the King James it says little children. So was it just a bunch of kids coming out? Little kindergartners run out and start making fun of Elisha? Here's what they said. They mocked him and said to him, "Go up, bald head. Go up, you bald head." Now, to me, that's personally offensive. The balder I get, the more offensive it is. It's just... Was Elisha bald? Well, we don't know, to be honest. But here what we see is this mocking going on. And again, here it says youths. The Hebrew word na'ar, N-A-A-R, can mean little ones, like little babes, you know, 2, 3, 4 year olds. But can also mean teenagers. And it can also mean young adult men. So what of that group was composing this mocking group? Probably young men. And again, you get young men with each other, and if they don't have God's Spirit, a great deal of foolishness and bad judgment can often follow. How many times did you hear your mother say, "If your friends jump off a cliff, you're going to jump off with them"? Why would she say things like that? Because young men, even with the influence of God's Spirit, sometimes can do foolish things. And they get together, and what was it at Camp Heritage? The ranger would always, in his orientation, say, "You know, you just got to keep your eyes on things here. When everybody's together, you got to keep your eyes on things." And nothing ever good starts with, "Hey, y'all, watch this." Right? You get the young men together, especially, and they do fool it. So these young men, possibly part of the idolatrous system in Bethel, they were ridiculing or mocking. The word here is mocking. They mocked him. And that's literally what it means, to disparage, to ridicule, to mock, to scorn, to scoff. So it's not just that this guy happened to be traveling by and they're making fun of him because he's bald. There was much more to it than that. And by the way, we asked the question, was Elisha actually bald? Probably not in one sense. He might have been. He was a very young man at this point as well. He'd lived for another 50 years after this. So it's not like he was an old man by any means. 1 in 20 men notice a receding hairline before age 21, in case you didn't know. 35% have some balding by age 35. 35, 35, you can remember that. By 45... 45% of men have loss of hair. And by 55%. There you go. So was he bald? Probably not. May he have had a receding hairline? That's possible. But the point is, here are these young men mocking him because of who he was and what he believed. So the punishment that he sends upon them from God makes much more sense when we look at it this way. Now, it's interesting that the only other time in the Scripture that this word for bald is used is in Leviticus 13, where priests examined a man who was losing his hair, who had sores on his head because of leprosy. So again, these guys are just not saying, "Hey, baldy." They're ridiculing him. His head, something's wrong with your head. What's wrong with you? That's the kind of snide, snarling kind of remarks that they're making. It's not just a matter of, "Hey, baldy." We can all take that. But this is a disrespectful disparaging of one of God's servants. So the punishment that he calls up makes much more sense. He went up from there to Bethel, verse 23, and as he was going up the road, some youths came from the city and mocked him, said, "Go up, you bald head, go up, you what's wrong with your head?" In essence, is what they're saying. Something's wrong with your brain, with your head. Something's wrong, verse 24. So he turned around and looked at them. Ooh, and you know when mom looks at you when you've done something you shouldn't? Or even if you have been good, that look still penetrates. It's like, He turned around and looked at them, pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Eternal. Again, if they're making fun of a baldy, is that going to happen? Of course not. That's not the point. The point is they're disrespecting God Himself by disrespecting God's servant. They're making fun of the Eternal, we might say, and His servants. So He turned around and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 42 of the youths. So we're talking about a mob, a gang of disrespectful, insolent young men. So He pronounces this curse. You've probably seen the T-shirt that says, you know, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And then back it says, except bears. Bears kill you. They found this out. The word for mauled means to tear apart. So it is very likely that 42 of these young, insolent, rebellious, snotty young men who were making fun of God and His servant were destroyed on the spot. Talk about a bad way to go. Bad way to go. So we might say that mocking is unwise. That's a good lesson to learn from these young men. These bears kill, or at least molest or tear at, maybe not tear apart, but again, the word literally means to tear asunder or tear apart, to rip apart. So whether they actually died or not, it was a very unpleasant experience. And more likely than not, they were dead. So we analyze ourselves and ask, are we pleasing God in this area? Have we become scorners or just mockers? There's a spirit in this culture of just mocking, mocking others. And again, it takes all forms, but more and more you see videos, let's say on the internet, where people will go do just kind of rude things to others for the entertainment value. They'll have somebody with a camera and they walk up to somebody else and slap something on them or do something, and it's all for this entertainment value. And it's sad to see that kind of thing. It's a mocking, scornful kind of spirit. So we ask, are we pleasing God or are we becoming scorners? An interesting one of the psalms we sing very often is, "Don't let me sit in the seat of the scorners," those who mock, who are constantly making fun of others in a malicious manner, belittling others with their speech. We certainly can learn from these young men and this miracle of calling the she-bears out of the woods on top of them, that we should show proper honor to God and to His servants and to human beings in general, not to be mocking and scorning along the way. Let's go on from there to a third lesson. We know that our well must be pure. We must be checking ourselves to be sure we're not polluting our well. We know that mocking is unwise. Let's go on to a third lesson that we might learn from Elisha's miracles. And that is this: God cares for, or we might put in parentheses, loves the widows. God cares for, He loves widows. If we go to 2 Kings chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, we have this generous, kind, spiritual woman who needs help. She's a widow. 2 Kings 4 and verse 1. A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha. Now we'll pause there for a second. In the scripture, this woman is not identified. All we're told is that she was a wife of one of the prophets. Which prophet? Well, we don't know, but the Jewish historian Josephus says that this was the widow of the prophet Obadiah. And if that's the case, that would be interesting. Maybe she did have a name, obviously. It's not given here. What is being shown is God's love and care for widows, not who she was. That wasn't the important thing. But Josephus says this was the widow of Obadiah. And Obadiah had gone into great debt because he borrowed money. But he borrowed money in order to feed the other prophets. At least that's Josephus' take on it. Again, the scripture doesn't say those details. They may or may not be true. We're not told how this prophet in the scripture got into debt, but that's the situation. He dies, and his wife is left with this debt. So she cries out to Elisha, saying, "Your servant, my husband, is dead. Your servant." So Elisha knew this person, knew who he was, knew what he did, knew his responsibilities. "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that your servant feared the Eternal. And the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves." Now that was not supposed to happen in Israel. According to the Old Testament agreements, you didn't make slaves out of fellow Hebrews. But in this case, the system had become so skewed over the course of time that people pretty much did what they wanted. So they were going to take her two sons and indenture them till they got their money back. So Elisha said to her, "What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?" And she said, "Your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil." A jar of oil was all that was left. So then he said, "Go, borrow vessels," or pots, jars, "from everywhere, from all your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few." In other words, fill your house with the empty jars, with the empty bottles, with the empty bowls. Go get as many as you possibly can. Do not gather just a few. "And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you and your sons, all three of you in the room. Then pour into all those vessels and set aside the full ones." So take that little cruse of oil that you have left and start pouring it into all these empty jars. And of course, that's impossible, except for the first bottle, until you drain the one that you had. But the fascinating thing is God suspended the laws that He created and multiplied the oil. Verse 6, "Now it came to pass, when the vessels were full..." verse 5. "So she went from him, shut the door behind her, and her sons, who brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out." She poured. "It came to pass, when the vessels were full, that she said to her son, 'Bring me another vessel.' And he said to her, 'There is not another vessel.'" In other words, we filled them all up. And at that point, the last drops of oil came out of the cruse that she was holding. The oil ceased. And she came and told the man of God. And he said, "Go, sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest." Now, we learn a couple of things about widows. They are serious when it comes to God. When he told her to go gather as many vessels as she could get, it's clear that she gathered so many that it could not just pay the debt that they owed, but they would live, apparently, for the rest of their lives on the oil money. And she wasn't even Texan. This is what you call real oil money. So all these jars all over the room. Maybe it's one room, maybe it's a couple rooms, but they kept pouring and pouring and pouring. So she's got this oil to sell. So she seriously did exactly what the prophet said. Don't gather just a few. Gather as many, in essence, as you can. And she did that. So it teaches us something about widows and how dependent they are. When God speaks to them, they follow. This is a wonderful, wonderful characteristic. But what do we learn? Well, I think as a church, we might look at this and say, well, if in fact this is Obadiah's widow, we have a responsibility to care for our ministers' wives. When they die in harness, we worked in the death, we need to take care of their wives. So at this point, the Church of God does. Cogwa takes care of half a dozen or eight ministers' widows because they've served alongside their husbands for many, many decades in most cases, and we have an obligation to be sure they're taken care of. So we do that. We literally do that. But figuratively, this is true as well. We know God will care for our widows. But he often does that through the actions and deeds of the rest of us. So if widows have not been on your radar, or widowers by extension, although widowers tend to be a little bit more self-supportive, the bottom line is, if widows have not been on our radar of service and kindness, they ought to be. In the same way that Elisha was touched by this and by her service and by her husband's service and the son's dilemma, we ought to likewise be touched and be sure that we're caring for those who might be in these kinds of circumstances. What a wonderful miracle, a wonderful way to remind us to take care of our widows. If you don't know who our widows are, just ask around. It becomes pretty obvious pretty quick. And how you can help probably will become pretty obvious as well. Let's continue on with another story, another miracle, another suspension of physical law. The fourth thing we might learn from Elisha's miracles is that God controls our birth, our life, our death, and our resurrection. God controls our birth, life, death, and resurrection. A fascinating miracle here in 2 Kings chapter 4. We'll begin in verse 8 to get some of the background. 2 Kings 4 in verse 8. Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem. Shunem was an area of Israel where there was a notable woman. In other words, she was wealthy. Her husband was wealthy. They did very well for themselves. And it says she persuaded him to eat some food. Come, eat with me. Almost sounds like the Martha of the New Testament. Come, we got food. I'll take care of you. We'll set this all up. So it was that as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. So every time he came past Shunem, he would stop at her home. She would feed him and wanted to house him when he was there. Verse 9, no need to pay Holiday Inn Express, you know, come stay at my house. Okay, there was no Holiday Inn Express, it was called the Shekel Inn. Yeah. And there was a place next door that the bad people stayed in called the Vile Inn, you know. People played pretty nasty there. Okay. Verse 9. She says to her husband, "Look now, I know this is a man of God, a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Let us make a small upper room on the wall and let us put a bed there for him and a table and a chair and a lamp. So it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in there. He'll have a place to stay. We want to honor God by making sure his servant is taken care of." In verse 11, it happened one day that he came there, he turned into the upper room and lay down there. So he did use that room. So it was like a bed and breakfast in one sense for the prophet as he passed through the area. Very kind of them to do. Verse 12, and he said to Gehazi, his servant, "Call the Shunammite woman." And when he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to him, "Say now to her, 'Look, you have been concerned for us with all this care.'" So not just a bed and a meal, but she even had those little mints in a bowl in the room. she thought of everything along the way. "What can I do for you? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? In other words, can I help in some way?" She answered, "Look, I dwell among my own people. No reason. I don't want to move anywhere. I don't want to be a part of the king's." In other words, he saw talent and ability here and, you know, "Can you serve in the king's court or to the army or something like that?" Verse 14, she said, "No, I'm here. I like to be among my own people." So he said, "What then is to be done for her?" And Gehazi answered, "Actually, she has no son and her husband is old." So he said, "Call her." When he had called her, she stood in the doorway. And he said, "About this time next year, you shall embrace a son." And she said, "No, my Lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant." So, interesting reaction. For so long, she had hoped for a child and probably had settled in her mind that it was not going to happen. And then to have him as a man of God, say, no, this is going to happen. She reacted in such a way as you might expect. Oh, no, that's I've already settled that. It's not going to happen. Don't lie to me. Verse 17. But the woman conceived and bore a son when the appointed time had come of which Elisha had told her. So God controlled the birth, literally in this case, made sure she conceived and brought a child into the world. Verse 18. And the child grew. Now it happened one day that he went out to his father, to the reapers. Some commentaries feel the son may have been a young teenager. Others say, no, he would have been younger than that. Still an elementary school kind of little guy. Impossible to tell from the account here. Other than that mother was still able to carry him. So he obviously wasn't 22. He was a little guy. Verse 19. And he said to his father, another, he gets out there to the field where his father was working with the servants. He said, my head, my head. And so he said to a servant, carry him to his mother. And obviously something's very wrong with this poor child. And again, people have wondered what might it have been that struck this poor child at this point. Was it a heat stroke or something like that that might have been bringing about this kind of reaction? We're not told. Verse 20, but when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat upon her knees until noon and then died. So talk about a terrible event. This son that she had hoped for lives just a few years and then dies in her lap. What a tragedy. How hard that must have been for her. Verse 21, she went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God and shut the door upon him and went out. Then she called to her husband and said, please send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come back. Now the indication seems to be that she hid from her husband the fact that the child had died. All she said is I need to make a trip to see the man of God. And he says in verse 23, so why are you going to him today? Well, it would have been obvious if he knew that the son had died. He assumed that he got a headache and was taken back by a servant and was resting or something like that. It's neither the new moon nor the Sabbath. That's when they might normally make a trip. And she said, it is well. Well, I just need to do this now. Verse 24, she saddled a donkey and said to her servant, drive and go forward. Do not slacken the pace for me unless I tell you. So this seems to be that she's sitting on the donkey and the servant's got the whip behind the donkey keeping this animal moving. And don't stop, keep going, pushing hard. So some would think, it was a 4 or 5 hour trip from where she was to Mount Carmel, where she was going to see Elisha. So she departed and went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So it was, when the man of God saw her afar off, that he said to his servant Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman. So he could tell whether it was her walk or her demeanor or her personality showed through in her travel. And he saw, recognized who it was. Run now to meet her and say to her, is it well with you? Is it well with your husband? Is it well with the child? And she answered, it is well. Now, that was not true. At least it doesn't seem to be true. But what was she trying to accomplish? Well, she wanted to get directly to Elisha as quickly as possible. And she just needed to move on. She didn't want to take the time to say, it looks like my son has died, and explain this all to the servant when she needed to get, in her mind, to Elisha as quickly as possible. Now, when she came to the man of God at the hill, she caught him by the feet. She just jumped off the donkey and fell at his feet. But Gehazi came near to push her away, like, what's going on? But the man of God said, let her alone, for her soul is in deep distress. So either God gave him that insight, or he could see that something was drastically wrong, that she'd held it together until this point, and she's just gushing emotion at this point. Her soul is in deep distress, and the Eternal has hidden it from me and has not told me. I don't know why she's in this state of mind. God normally would have revealed these things to him, but he didn't at this point. Verse 28, so she said, "Did I ask a son of my Lord?" I mean, did I ask for this kid? No. I didn't ask. And yet, I was granted. Didn't I say, don't deceive me? So all this pent-up emotion is now pouring out. This is a good lesson, by the way, for servants of God. Sometimes people dump emotionally on you. Is it like Elisha's fault the kid died? No, but it just happens that way. It's this emotion. Look, I didn't ask for this child, and I said, don't deceive me. And I had this child for a couple of years, and now he's died, and it's really your fault. I'm suffering this way because of all this thing that... And she's going on and on. Didn't I say, don't deceive me? Verse 29. Then he said to Gehazi, get yourself ready. Pack the bags. Take my staff in your hand and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. If anyone greets you, do not answer him, but lay my staff on the face of the child. So his walking stick was supposed to be taken by Gehazi and placed on the child. Now, we're not told specifically why this was the case. Was this going to heal the child? Possibly. Maybe it was a sign of Elijah's protection being there until the time he could arrive or something like that. Some would say, well, no, this was a Eastern practice of magic, and I don't believe any of that's true necessarily at all. But the mother of the child said, as the Eternal lives, and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. Now, it may be that like an anointed cloth, the staff on the face of a child was what God could use to heal. He could certainly do that. This woman, as wonderful as she was, as giving as she was, as desirous of serving God as she was, did not have the faith to think that that stick could do anything. And again, those without faith would look the same way at an anointed cloth. Cloth can't do anything. Well, that's true. It doesn't. It's a symbol of God stepping in to heal directly himself. And that it was something she just didn't feel was possible. So she simply said, I can't leave you. You have got to come. You've got to be there. So, end of verse 30, he arose and followed her. Of course, Gehazi had a head start. He went on ahead, verse 31, of them, and laid the staff on the face of the child, but there was neither voice nor hearing. In other words, that didn't do it. Therefore, he went back to meet the two of them as they were coming and told him, Elisha, saying, the child has not awakened. When Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying dead on his bed. He went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Eternal. He literally begins to beg God for the child's life to be returned to him. Prays to the Eternal. And he went up and lay on the child and put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, his hands on his hands, and stretched himself out on the child. And the flesh of the child became warm. Now again, for us, that just seems odd. And to our culture, it would be. But what is the symbol here? The symbol is passing life. So he lays on top of the child, apparently, just as he would, and face to face and body to body, and this life, in essence, this heat is starting to transfer. Now again, is that how it worked? Well, verse 35, it says, he returned and walked back and forth in the house and went up again and stretched himself out on him. Then the child sneezed 7 times, and the child opened his eyes. A miraculous event takes place, and the child is resurrected to physical life. We tease. I mean, it's an amazing miracle. But we tease, he must have been allergic to Elisha. He sneezes 7 times. Why sneeze? I don't know. Sneezes 7 times. I wonder, in several pagan religions, sneezing is something to be feared. Because when you sneeze, you open yourself, your soul kind of leaves for a moment, and then you have to, you know, you have to, you could be attacked by demons at that point, false spirits. So as a result, you have to be blessed when you sneeze. So out of those pagan cultures comes this habit when someone sneezes, oh, bless you. Most people have no concept at all what they're saying or why they're saying it. It's just what you do. Well, it comes directly out of these pagan myths about the immortal soul and things like that. So we don't say bless you when someone sneezes. Gesundheit in German or things like that. We don't do that. Or we can say sorry you're sneezing or here's a hanky. You know, those are appropriate things. Or please don't cough on me. We were on the plane last night. We have two seats and then there's a hole next to us and then the door to the plane to get out over the wing. And so the guy behind is pushing his things up under the seat next to Pam there. And the whole time he's just hacking and coughing. You cannot get away from it when you're in this little plane. So I have my Packer scarf and we kind of hold it up to our arm. Trying to make it without being coughed all over. But the bottom line is here, he sneezes seven times. And I wonder if that isn't kind of a bit of poking fun, in one sense, at these pagan religions that thought the soul somehow left your body when you sneeze. The exact opposite is happening. Life is coming back into his body when he's sneezing, not the other way around. So I wonder, that's only a speculation, but I wonder if why sneezing? I don't know, but that seems to be about the only explanation I could come up with as to why it's sneezing and not something else. But nonetheless, he sneezes seven times and he opens his eyes, a spectacular miracle. Brethren, nothing happens without God's knowledge in our lives, without His involvement, without His permission. He is in charge of our birth, our life, our death, and our resurrection. And that's what's most important. He's able to resurrect the dead. In this case, He resurrected this little boy, this young man. A child, we assume, because mother was the one that had him on her knees until he died. So he was a tiny little guy in one sense, small babe. But nonetheless, God resurrected him from the dead. Now, it's interesting that Elijah had done something similar, been used to do something similar. If you turn back to 1 Kings 17, 1 Kings 17, you might remember this story as well. It was not like, in one sense, Elisha's, that he wondered what could possibly be done for this very kind, generous woman who was looking out for the servants of God. A little bit different one here, 1 Kings 7, in verse 8. The word of the Lord came to Elijah, saying, arise, go to Zarephath. 1 Kings 17, verse 9. Arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. See, I've commanded a widow there to provide for you. So famine all over the land. God sends Elijah to a widow. She wanted to help. Well, at least she was willing to help. Verse 10. He arose, went to Zarephath, and when he came to the gate of the city, indeed, there's a widow there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, please bring me a little water in a cup that I may drink. And as she was going to get it, which would have been typical custom there, he called to her and said, please bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. So she said, as the Lord lives, Lord your God lives, I do not have bread. Only a handful of flour in a bin and a little oil in a jar. And see, I'm gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in, prepare it for myself and my son that we may eat it and die. This is our last food. We're going to have our last meal and then it's over for us. Verse 13, Elijah said to her, do not fear. Go and do as you have said, but make me a small cake from it first and bring it to me. And afterward, make some for yourself and your son. For thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bin of flour shall not be used up, nor the jar of oil run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the earth. Similar miracle to the oil in Elisha's day. So she went and did according to the word of Elijah. And she said, and she and he and her household ate for many days. The bin of flour was not used, nor did the jar run oil or oil run dry, according to the word of the Eternal, which we spoke by Elijah. So again, a spectacular miracle, suspending the laws of nature. This widow and her son are the center of the story. Now it happened, verse 17, after these things, that the son of the woman who owned the house became sick. And his sickness was so serious that there was no breath left in him. Now, as far as I know, when there's no breathing, you're dead. At least that seems to be the case. So she said to Elijah, you have a similar outpouring of this emotion. What have I to do with you, O man of God? Have you come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and kill my son? There's a lot that could be said about that. But here again, this outpouring of emotion, and he happens to be the target instead of what really should be. So maybe there's something in her past that she felt terribly guilty about, and she felt that sin now was being repaid by the death of her son. What likely was the case? The kid got sick and died. End of story. That's what it was. So, again, Elijah felt tremendous compassion for her. She was a dedicated servant. She was willing to give that last cake to him during that time of famine so long ago. He saw her as a wonderful servant of God. So verse 19, he said, give me your son. So he took him out of her arms, carried him to the upper room where he was staying, laid him on his own bed. Ever wonder where Elisha got the idea? Well, here's where it's from. Verse 20, he cried out to the Eternal and said, O Lord, my God, have you also brought tragedy on the widow with whom I lodge by killing her son? That's not what you're intending, are you? Verse 21, he stretched himself out on the child three times and cried out to the Eternal and said, O Lord, my God, I pray, let this child's life, as it should read, his soul, come back to him. Then the Eternal heard the voice of Elijah. In other words, a soul doesn't do much good. If you think of an immortal soul, what good is an immortal soul if you're not breathing? You're still dead. It's life that had to come back into him. His life. So he stretched out three times and prayed that God would restore the life. Verse 22. And the Eternal heard the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came back to him, and he revived. Elijah took the child and brought him down from the upper room into the house, gave him to his mother, and Elijah said, see, your son lives. And the woman said to Elijah, now by this I know you are a man of God, and the word of the Eternal in your mouth is truth, is the truth. So that's probably where Elisha came up with the understanding of the idea that he likewise would stretch himself up out over this child and restore life, that God would use this to restore life. Christ did say, I am the resurrection. So when we face struggles and trials and difficulties in our life, we must remember the son of the Shunammite woman, that nothing happens without God's knowledge, without his involvement, without his permission. He is in charge, and he is most importantly able to resurrect the dead. So we look forward to that. Resurrection from the dead is physically impossible. But with God, nothing is impossible. Let's go on to a fifth lesson from one of Elisha's miracles. The fifth thing we might learn, tongue in cheek to start, don't eat what some people cook. Let's look at this story in 2 Kings chapter 4. What do we mean by that? Mistakes happen. Mistakes happen. 2 Kings chapter 4, beginning in verse 38. Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in the land. Now the sons of the prophets were sitting before him, and he said to his servant, put on the large pot and boil stew for the sons of the prophets. Anyone ever read the book Stone Soup? Similar. 2 Kings 4, verse 39 starts the story of stone soup in one sense. Verse 39, so one went out into the field to gather herbs and found a wild vine and gathered from it a lapful of wild gourds and came and sliced them into the pot of stew, though they did not know what they were. How often would you put something you have no idea what it is into a pot and then eat it? Some people should not be allowed to cook. And I have tried some of their meals. No, I'm kidding. I haven't. Just teasing. Although there was an event many, many, many years ago where we went to a person's home in another state, by the way, not here. And we were served pizza, or at least what they called pizza. And the most unique ingredient, I mean, pizzas today have lots of things on it. You get Greek pizzas with, you know, goat cheese and vegetables and stuff like that. Well, for whatever reason, maybe it's just because I hate peas, she had put on the pizza a can of peas on top of the pizza. And so, and there like wasn't any red sauce. You know, like you expect like there's sauce on pizza. There's like no sauce. And so all these peas had been in the oven and baked to a nice hard rock-like consistence. So some people really shouldn't cook. That's just all. That's the conclusion I came to. But so I'm sure if you could have had a video of that meal, it would have been hilarious as you try to eat these rock-hard peas on top of this dough that was cooked somehow. Nonetheless, the point is mistakes happen. Mistakes happen. Ever been in a situation in your life where you've just made a terrible mistake? God is very merciful, and so hopefully are His servants, as Elisha was. Went out, gathered herbs, found a wild vine, gathered a lap full of wild gourds, and came and sliced them into the pot of stew. They did not know what they were, verse 40. And they served it to the men to eat. Now it happened as they were eating the stew that they cried out, "Man of God, there's death in the pot!" And they could not eat it. So literally they were getting sick, apparently, right and left. And there's been some research as to what kind of herb could this have been, or wild vine and gourds. And they have come up with a couple possibilities that give almost immediate gastric troubles when you eat them, and literally can lead to death. So they were probably not exaggerating when they said there's death in the pot. They weren't trying to insult the cook. They were simply saying something is drastically wrong here. So this individual was striving to help. He found all these gourds. Now, apparently he didn't ask himself the question that everything else from the land has been stripped. Why are these gourds still here? Well, because they're poisonous was the answer, but he didn't know that. So he cuts them up into the soup and almost killed all of the prophets. Prophets as in people, not money. Verse 41, so he said, Elisha says, "Then bring some flour." And he put it into the pot and said, "Serve it to the people that they may eat." And there was nothing harmful in the pot. Now it's interesting to think about who was the first one to have that next bowl of soup. That's a man of faith. The prophet said, it's going to be fine. Now again, does flour have some anti-poisonous properties? Of course not. It was again symbolic that we're covering this, that God is overseeing it. So innocent mistakes can be very costly, but God is able to forgive those mistakes. And frankly, He's able to avert some of the consequences of those honest mistakes. He doesn't always take away all consequences, but many times God is very, very merciful. And He abrogates some of those consequences and sets them aside because He loves us, because He loves His people. So mistakes happen. Not only did the mistake happen, and then God intervene through this flour that Elisha sprinkles in and spares them from this terrible mistake. Verse 42, a man came from Baal Shalisha and brought the man of God bread of the first fruits. As you know, it's a custom in God's church and certainly in Old Testament Israel to bring the first fruits of the harvest forward for God's servants. So that's what this individual is doing. He harvested, and the very first loaves of bread that were made from this small harvest went to the priests, or in this case, to the servants of God. 20 loaves of barley bread. And the reason we say it's got to be in the springtime, we would assume that's when barley gets ripe, the first ripe there. The newly ripened grain in his knapsack. So he brings this bread and brings a bushel of grain, or however much it was, a knapsack full. And he says, give it to the people that they may eat. So Elisha says, here's these 20 small loaves. And again, when we think of loaves, we think of a pretty good sized loaf of bread. Loaves at that point were a single serving. You made a loaf and you ate it, because there was no way to store bread, and it would get hard and stale very, very quickly. So you made bread and you ate it right at that point. Flat bread, very likely, may or may not have been leavened, probably not leavened in this case. But nonetheless, go ahead and give these 20 individual loaves to the people. And the servant said, what? Shall I set this before 100 men? There's 100 of us. We got these 20 cakes. How are we all supposed to eat that? 100, 20 divided by 100, let's see, that gives us each one bite out of this group. And he said, give it to the people that they may eat. For thus says the Eternal, they shall eat and have some left over. Sounds like the feeding of 4,000 or the feeding of 5,000 in the New Testament. So he set it before them and they ate and had some left over. Some left over, according to the word of the Eternal. So when mistakes happen, God is not only able to make up for those mistakes, to forgive them, to remove consequences, he can bring blessing on top of that. And when these loaves are multiplied, that seems to be what is happening. Any vestige of that mistake is now in the past. And that's very good. Well, we've reached about the end of what we have time to cover for today. We've been at it for just about an hour. So we'll call it quits at this point and pick up with the final miracles of Elisha's life next time. And again, remember, miracles are something that are impossible on the physical level, but very possible with God's intervention. We enjoy God's intervention in these ways, but let's be sure we're applying the lessons that we might learn from the spectacular miracles performed through Elisha.
Thank you, Mr. Myers. If you'd all take up your hymnals once again and please stand and turn to page number 159 to conclude. We'll sing hymn number 159.